All right, good morning. The topic that I'd like to address this morning can be very simply put, and that is, what are the origins of the Pesach Seder? Now, the question is not as simple as you might suppose, and that is because it's not clear why exactly the Pesach Seder should actually exist. Of course, we know that during both the First and Second Temple periods, basically the ritual on the night of the 14th was completely centered upon the Korban Pesach. We know that basically, you can already take a look at your source sheets. If you see under the second source there, where it says Shmot Perek Yud Bet, you look at Pasuk Chet there, V'achlu et ha-basar ba-layla hazeh, tzli'esh u-matzot, al-merorim yochluhu. Okay, they would eat meat this night, meaning on the night of the 14th, roasted, accompanied by matzah and maror. So the question is, what could actually take the place of this sacrificial ritual, which was the way in which they practiced it during the Second Temple period? What exactly could replace that ritual after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 CE? Now, we know that it couldn't have been a seamless transition, and that's because we know from various sources, both in rabbinic literature and from other works written around that time, that there was an existential crisis among the Jews following the destruction. Okay, we're not going to read this inside, but you can see from the top source there, you can read it later, that there was an outbreak of asceticism following the destruction. What the Tosefta there calls prushin, or ascetics, became rampant, and the question was how to respond to them. They felt, how could they go on following the destruction of the temple? They had always eaten meat as part of the sacrifice. How could they continue eating meat? They had done various other rituals surrounding wine and water. How could they continue drinking wine and water? And the response by Rabbi Yehoshua there is that you have to continue life as normal. It's just that you'll begin to commemorate that earlier set of rituals. And here we're talking not simply about the Korban Pesach, but sacrifices in general. You can continue living as normal. It's just that you will begin commemorating the temple in various subtle ways. That wasn't, at least at first glance, a possibility for replacing Korban Pesach. It would seem that replacing any particular Korban was a matter of all or nothing, right? Rabbi Yehoshua's response was, you can't continue offering Korbanot, obviously. What you can do is you can create certain commemorations that will allow you to have the temple in your consciousness going forward. But how exactly would they substitute for the Korban Pesach? What I want to look at is two sets of responses, two sets of ways in which the Second Temple gave rise to what we now call the Seder. And what I'm going to suggest is that this transition from the Korban Pesach during the Second Temple period to what we know as the Seder actually took place in two stages. The first stage, I think, is represented by Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel, we know, is the grandson of the person that we know as Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, namely the person named Rabban Gamliel who lived toward the end of the Second Temple period. The Rabban Gamliel that we're going to be focusing on is his grandson, Rabban Gamliel II, who was the head of the yeshiva at various points in Yavne in around the year 90 CE. Okay, so he's living in the generation immediately following the destruction of the temple. What we'll see in a moment is that Rabban Gamliel's ritual, or his set of practices surrounding the ritual on the night of the 14th, basically consisted of three different practices. The first practice is what we'll see the various sources refer to as a gedi mikulas. Okay, so that is literally a helmeted gedi, a helmeted kid. What we mean by a helmet here is that its entrails would be wrapped around its head as if it were a helmet. Now, that gedi mikulas, as we'll see in a moment, was roasted in the same manner as the Korban Pesach had been roasted during the temple period. And apparently, it was a very controversial practice for obvious reasons. If what I said before is that other sources suggest that it wasn't possible to continue with sacrifices after the temple period, the question is, how could you actually continue bringing this helmeted kid, which looks so much like the Korban Pesach? That was the first of his practices, and we'll look inside in a moment to see where exactly Rabban Gamliel seems to have done that, and what exactly the source of opposition to that practice was. The second practice of his, again following the Second Temple period, was that he apparently stayed up all night to learn the various Hilchot HaPesach, and here Hilchot HaPesach would seem to refer specifically to the Korban Pesach. And so not only was he eating some type of food which very closely resembled the Korban Pesach, but he was actually continuing to learn the laws surrounding the Korban Pesach throughout the night. And the third practice, which I think is more familiar to us from both the Mishnah and from the Haggadah, is that Rabban Gamliel mandated the recitation of three separate things at the Seder. He said you have to recite Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, and provide the symbolism behind each of those different foods. You have to explain why Pesach, Matzah, and Maror signify something important about Yitziat Mitzrayim, about the Exodus. Okay, let's take a look at each of those three discrete practices of Rabban Gamliel's and try to think about how exactly they hang together. What exactly was Rabban Gamliel trying to accomplish in instituting these three separate rituals? So if you look on the top of page 2 for a moment, there are three primary sources in rabbinic literature that talk about this gedi mikulas, this helmeted kid. The first is that top source on page 2. This is from the Mishnah and Masechet Beitza. Look at the underlined portion toward the end of that Mishnah. V'osin gedi mikulas b'leilei psachim. There's one position that says that you would bring this helmeted kid on the night of the 14th. V'chachamim osrin. But the chachamim, meaning the majority of the rabbis, forbade this particular practice. The question is why? What exactly was the source of their opposition? And so to understand that better, take a look at the third source there, the Tosefta in Masechet Beitza. And again, we're going to be looking at the underlined portion there. Amar Rabbi Yosa, and so here, both the Mishnah and the Tosefta are basically being edited in around the same time period, and so we're talking about the beginning of the 3rd century CE, or about 150 years after the destruction of the temple. Amar Rabbi Yosa, Todos Ish... Amar Rabbi Yosa, Rabbi Yosi said the following, Todos Ish Romi, Hinhig et b'nei Romi, likach tzela'im b'leilei psachim. There was this person named Todus who lived in Rome who instituted the practice of taking these kids on the night of Pesach, v'osin otan mekulasin. And again, he would practice this helmeted kid. This is what he would bring. Amrulo, but the majority of people, and again, it's not clear who exactly these majority are, whether these are the rabbis in Israel or whether these are other rabbis who live in Rome. Amrulo, afku karov leha'achil kadshim bachutz, mipnei shekorin otam psachin. What you're doing by bringing this gedi mikulas looks very much like the practice of bringing a Korban Pesach, which was problematic after the destruction of the temple. And so the source of opposition, which we saw already in that first Mishnah, is precisely because this practice resembles so closely the earlier practice, which obviously was now defunct. What's interesting is if you look in that second source on that page, from the Mishnah and Masechet Psachim, Ein solin et ha-pesach al hashvud velo al ha-askala. You cannot roast the Korban Pesach either on a spit or a grate, because the Korban Pesach has to be roasted directly on the fire, and if you instead prepare the Korban Pesach on either a spit or a grate, it's only being secondarily roasted, and so that's a problem. Now the Mishnah quotes a precedent for that fact, that the Korban Pesach cannot be roasted on either a spit or a grate, by reference to a practice of Rabban Gamliel. Amar Rabbi Tzadok, Ma'aseh b'Rabban Gamliel, she'amar l'tevi avdo, tsei utzlei lanu et ha-pesach al ha'askala. Rabban Gamliel was said to have said to his servant Tevi, and now we know that the Rabban Gamliel who's being referred to here is not the first Rabban Gamliel who I said was alive during the first temple period, because we know that the second Rabban Gamliel, who was alive after the destruction, had this servant named Tevi. We know that from other sources. And yet this first Rabban Gamliel said to his servant, go and roast for us a Pesach on the Askala, on this grate. So what's interesting here is several things. First of all, it's clear that he intended some distinction between the Korban Pesach and his Gedi. right? But his gedi mikulas, this helmeted kid, and the korban pesach, and that's why he would roast it on a grate rather than directly on the fire, because he wanted to demonstrate this is not exactly like the korban pesach. On the other hand, notice the formulation: tse utzleilanu et ha-pesach. Go and roast for us the pesach. And we just saw in the previous passage in the Tosefta that that was precisely the source of opposition by the other rabbis. The problem was calling this gedi mikulas a pesach, because if you called it a pesach, that made it resemble the earlier korban pesach. And so here Rama Gamliel seems to side with the minority view, that of Todos Ish Romi, and again the anonymous person in the first Mishnah, against the majority, who say that it's not possible to continue instituting this practice. And yet, one of Rabbi Gamliel's important innovations was to try to continue, on some level, the practice of bringing Korban Pesach in the form of a gedi mikulas. So that was, in some ways, Rabbi Gamliel's most far-reaching practice after the destruction of the temple. But we actually need to connect it with the other two practices of Rabbi Gamliel that I mentioned before. The first of which was to study the halachot of the Korban Pesach all night. And so for this, let's look at the page 3 for a moment. Sorry, we're actually going back to page 1. Sorry about that. So page 1, you see that the last set of sources is from the Tosefta and Masechet Pesachim. Everybody see that? That's the underlined. The last three sources are from the Tosefta. If you look in the middle of that set of three sources, so we're at the second to last source on the page, Halacha Yud Aleph, Ein Maftirin Achar HaPesach, if you go, let's skip to the middle there, Chayav Adam La'asok B'Hilchot HaPesach Kol HaLayla, person is required to study the halachot of Pesach, and here we're referring specifically to the Hilchot Korban Pesach, the laws of the Korban Pesach, Kol HaLayla, the entire night, Afilu Beino Levein Beino, Afilu Beino Levein Atzmo, Afilu Beino Levein Talmido. You have to study it even if you're by yourself, certainly if you're with your son or your disciple. So that's a general statement of the law. In the next source, in Halacha Yud Bet, the Tosefta brings a precedent to this effect. Ma'aseh b'Rabban Gamliel uzkenim, shehayu misubin b'veit baitos ben zunin belod. Rabban Gamliel and the other elders would sit in the house of Baitos in Lud and study the Hilchot HaPesach Kol HaLayla ad krot hageber, right, until the morning. Meaning Rama Gamliel is a precedent to the statement which we found stated previously in the Tosefta, namely that you're supposed to be studying the halachot of the Korban Pesach the entire night. And at first glance, we should be connecting these two practices of Rama Gamliel, namely the fact that he continued bringing the gedi mikulas and the fact that he continued learning the halachot about Korban Pesach. The idea is to somehow continue to make relevant that earlier Second Temple practice, both by bringing a food which resembled the Korban and by studying the laws of the Korban at first glance. The third practice, and again I said this is the more well-known of the three practices of Rabban Gamliel, is found on the bottom of page 2. So now we're on in the Mishnah in Masechet Pesachim. Take a look at the bottom source on page 2. Rabban Gamliel haya omer, and this should be familiar from the Haggadah. Rabban Gamliel haya omer, kol shelo amar shlosha dvarim elu ba-pesach, lo yatza yidei chovato. If you don't recite the following three things, and it's clear that he doesn't simply mean to recite them, to simply say the words, but he actually means to interpret them. You have to interpret Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Pesach, why do we recite Pesach? Al shum shepasach hamakom al batei avotenu b'Mitzrayim, because God passed over the houses of our ancestors in Mitzrayim. Matzah al shum shenigalu avotenu b'Mitzrayim. Matzah, because our forefathers were redeemed from Mitzrayim. Maror al shum shemeru hamitzrim et chayei avotenu b'Mitzrayim. And maror, because the Egyptians embittered the lives of our ancestors. And so these are the three reasons why we eat these three different things on the night of Pesach. So how is it that this practice of reciting the three, these the symbolism behind these three different practices would connect with Rabban Gamliel's other two practices, namely bringing the Gedi Mikulas and learning the Halachot. So it would seem to be that this final ritual of Rabban Gamliel's was a way of justifying the continued practice of the Korban Pesach, of the Gedi Mikulas. Why is it that you are permitted to bring the Gedi Mikulas on the night of Pesach? Because the Korban Pesach isn't simply a static ritual. Rather, it has deep symbolism, namely the fact that we're commemorating God's redemption. And so therefore, you continue bringing the Gedi Mikulas because that symbolism continues to be relevant. And so it's a way of justifying that more controversial of its practices by giving expression to the symbolism underlying the Korban Pesach. Now, that's at first glance. At first glance, these three practices hang together as a way of continuing the earlier Second Temple practice. But what I'd like to suggest is an alternative interpretation of these three different practices, namely that the final two practices of learning the halachot of the night and of interpreting these three different foods actually has the effect of undermining the Gedi Mikulas. That what Rabban Gamliel, and I will go through the sources to elaborate on this in a minute, what Rabban Gamliel was essentially trying to do was, on the one hand, make it seem like it's possible to continue bringing the Korban Pesach, while on the other hand, subverting that ritual, trying to show the people that at the same time that we can kind of continue it, actually the Korban Pesach really has no place in our post-temple society. So he's making a very subtle move, on the one hand continuing the practice, while on the other hand undermining it. Let's look through some of the sources to see exactly how that works. The first thing that we need to look at is the statement of Rabban Gamliel that you're supposed to interpret the three different foods on the night of the Pesach. Now, what's interesting about that is that if you look in the Torah, the Korban Pesach is the primary ritual on the night of the 14th, and the matzah and the maror are really almost accompanying appetizers. At the end of that parak that we looked at before, Shmot Parak Yudbet, the Torah anticipates the son's question to his father, and the son is going to ask, what is this ritual in which you are partaking on the 14th? Maha avodah hazot lachem. And the father's answer is, because God passed over our ancestors' houses in antiquity. The question focuses exclusively on the Korban Pesach, ignoring the fact that the Korban is associated with matzah and maror, and the answer likewise ignores the fact that there is accompanying matzah and maror, and focuses exclusively on the Korban Pesach. Meaning, if we look in the Torah, it's not clear that the matzah and the maror that accompany the Korban Pesach have any symbolic significance. At least the Torah doesn't supply for us any symbolic significance to that matzah and maror. So Rabban Gamliel's far-reaching innovation here is to provide some symbolism to the matzah and the maror. Symbolism which was not apparent in the Torah itself. It's clear that Rabban Gamliel had in mind that passage in Parak Yudbet in Shmot. Namely, what he's trying to do is to provide symbolism for the matzah and maror where they're actually absent in the Torah. And it's clear if we look at the top of page 3. Now, what we're going to do in several steps is to compare the printed edition of our Mishnah with some of the better manuscripts of our Mishnah. Okay, the printed edition is inferior to some of the better manuscripts because we have several different sets of manuscripts of the Mishnah, those that were transmitted in the Middle Ages independent of the Gemara. That is, there were specific areas in Israel and in Italy in which Mishnah continued to be studying by itself, and it was in those places that the earlier, better texts of the Mishnah continue to be transmitted. We have several of those manuscripts, one of which is called the Kaufman manuscript, and here the Kaufman manuscript seems to preserve a better version of Rabban Gamliel's statement, which will show us his innovation here, namely that he is providing symbolism for the matzah and the maror. Take a look first at the top of page 3. We're looking at the top table on page 3. On the right-hand side of that box, is the printed edition of our Mishnah. Now, the printed edition of our Mishnah essentially has four different sections, the first of which is Rabbi Gamliel's statement that you have to interpret the Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. The second section of that Mishnah is the set of symbolisms in the same sequence, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. The third section of that Mishnah is the passage which is again familiar to us from the Haggadah, namely, Bechol Dor Vador, in every generation, we have to imagine ourselves as if we left Mitzrayim. And the fourth section of that Mishnah, again, a passage which is familiar to us from the end of Magid, namely the beginning of Hallel. After we recite at the Seder that we need to imagine ourselves as if we left Mitzrayim, we say, therefore, because we ourselves left Mitzrayim, therefore we ourselves have to praise God, have to recite Hallel. That's the four sections of the printed Mishnah. But there are a number of differences between the printed Mishnah and what I said before are the better manuscripts of the Mishnah. And this will give us better insight into what Rabbi Gamliel is doing. Okay, this is not simply an exercise in comparing manuscripts, but it's going to show us what Rabbi Gamliel's innovation here is. The first difference between the two manuscripts is that Rabbi Gamliel's first statement, anybody who didn't interpret the following three foods did not fulfill his requirement at the night of Pesach. And what are those three foods? Those three foods are not referred to Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Rather, they're referred to as Pesach, Matzah, and Merorim. Now, why is that important? Why is it important that he's changed the wording of the bitter herbs from Maror to Merorim? Because it shows us that Rabbi Gamliel has in mind the Maror from Shmot Perek Yud Bet. What I said before is that the formulation in Shmot Perek Yud Bet is that you have to bring the Pesach al matzot umerorim, accompanied by not matzah and maror, but by matzah and merorim. And so what Rabbi Gamliel is telling us by saying not maror, but merorim, is that what he's about to do is to provide the symbolism not only for the Korban Pesach, which is found in Shmot Perek Yud Bet, but also for the matzah and maror, which are found in Shmot Perek Yud Bet, significantly without symbolism. What I said before is that the matzah and maror are not explained as having any symbolic meaning in the Torah. So what Rabbi Gamliel here is going to do is to fill in the gaps of the Torah, supplying the symbolic significance for the matzah and the maror. And he does this in a way which, again, is different from our printed Mishnah, because the sequence of those symbolisms is not, as in our Mishnah, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. The sequence of the symbolism, if you continue down on, now we're on the left-hand column of the box, what's the order of the symbolisms for Rabbi Gamliel? Pesach, Merorim, and Matzah. Not Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. So why did he switch the order, again, in these better manuscripts, which would seem to preserve the more original statements of Rabbi Gamliel? Why does Rabbi Gamliel originally say that you have to interpret Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, and then in actually interpreting them, the sequence is Pesach, Maror, and Matzah? Why does he shift?
Historically,
yeah. How so?
Matzah was the last.
Okay, so we'll come to that. The reason why he switches the order from Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, which is the sequence both in the Torah, al matzot umerorim, and also in his original statement that you need to interpret Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, the reason why he switches the order needs to be understood in light of the second difference between these two manuscripts. Because the second difference between these two manuscripts is that in our manuscript of the Mishnah, our printed manuscript, what follows those interpretations is Bechol Dor Vador. You interpret Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, and then you say, in every generation we imagine ourselves as having left Mitzrayim, and then because you imagine yourself as having left Mitzrayim, then you praise God. In the better manuscripts of the Mishnah, b'chol dor vador is absent. And so in these better manuscripts, the transition is directly from the interpretation of matzah to the recitation of Hallel. Take a look at the sequence in this Mishnah on the left-hand side in the Kaufman manuscript. Pesach al shepasach hamakom al batei avoteinu b'mitzrayim. Korban Pesach comes first. Merorim al shemeruru hamitzrim et chayei avoteinu b'mitzrayim. Maror comes second. But matzah comes third, meaning the order of matzah and maror is inverted. Matzah al shum shenigalu. Matzah because they were redeemed. And then after we say because they were redeemed, then we recite Hallel. And so why is it that the original statements of Rabban Gamliel inverted the order of matzah and maror? In order to say that matzah is the reason why we recite Hallel. The reason why we recite Hallel, according to Rabban Gamliel, is because the symbolism of matzah is the one that prompts Hallel. The symbolism of matzah, according to Rabban Gamliel, is that they were redeemed. And once we remember that our ancestors were redeemed, then we go directly into the recitation of Hallel, the praising of God. You only appreciate that what Rabban Gamliel has done is juxtaposed matzah to the Hallel if you look in these better manuscripts. And so what has Rabban Gamliel done in inverting the order of matzah and maror and making matzah the reason why we recite Hallel, matzah al shum shenigalu? What has he done with the matzah relative to the Korban Pesach? He's de-emphasized the Pesach. Very good. What he's done is he's made matzah the primary food of the three, and therefore it's the matzah and not the Korban Pesach which would explain the reason for Hallel. So it's not simply that Rabban Gamliel shows the symbolic significance of the matzah and maror in a way in which it's not clear from the Torah, meaning it's not simply that he now equates the matzah and maror to the Korban Pesach. All of them have their own significance. But actually what Rabban Gamliel has done is he has now relegated the Korban Pesach to secondary status. It's the matzah itself and not the Korban Pesach which is of primary significance. And so if we talk about what has Rabban Gamliel done with this second part of his ritual, the first part of his ritual was to bring the helmeted kid. The second part of his ritual was to recite these three things. There's tension there. What he's actually done is at the same time that he's bringing this helmeted kid, at the same time he's saying that helmeted kid is really of lesser status than the matzah. And that was actually true in the time of the Beit HaMikdash as well. The Korban Pesach was always of secondary status relative to the matzah. And how do we see that? Again, because in the original formulation in the Mishnah, it's matzah which is responsible for the recitation of Hallel.
It's so, a more logical sequence, the manuscript.
How so?
If you just put it down, the first thing is Pesach. That's what God started with. Then after Pesach, he's saying, you know why I had Pesach? Because you had Maruru in. And then the last thing is when you had matzah.
Possibly, but if I were doing it in order, I would say maror first, then Pesach, because chronologically they were bitter.
Yeah, but I'd have matzah the last
right.
one anyway.
Either way, however it is that you would logically situate them, the important thing is to show, first of all, that the sequence of Rabban Gamliel's statement is neither that of the Torah, which is Pesach, matzah, and maror, or the original sequence of Rabban Gamliel's statement itself, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. So you see that he's intentionally inverting the order because it doesn't actually match even his original statement. Okay, is that clear? Have I... Yes? Yes? Okay, yes.
Here's an explanation, but I have an explanation that you can appreciate Matzah better if you want freedom when you go out to the primary expression of Hallel Slayer, whereas it's an emotional thing. Yours sounds like the more logical, but I've heard saying...
Right, that's a very fair point. Very, very fair point. I'm suggesting something different, but that's a very fair point. So if... Yes?
that matzah is an equivocal symbol, unlike the others, which only have one symbol, because matzah symbolizes both freedom and oppression.
Right, that's true, but here it's clear that this is matzah in the positive sense. Right. Right. Now, I think that if what Rabbi Gamliel is actually trying to accomplish is, at the same time that he is continuing the practice of the Korban Pesach, he is also relegating it to secondary status, I think he's actually doing something similar in studying the laws of Pesach itself. What is studying the laws of Pesach, which we saw earlier is the third piece of his night? Studying the laws of Pesach, Talmud Torah, of course, was there at much earlier points historically, but it becomes an especially significant religious practice after the destruction of the Second Temple. Because after the destruction of the Second Temple, already the rabbis say, the only way in which we can now access God, or at least one of the primary ways, is through study of Torah. And so what Rabbi Gamliel is doing by spending the majority of his night on the study of the laws, yes, he's studying the laws of the Pesach, but by including Talmud Torah as an important component of his evening, what he's actually doing is accommodating this earlier practice to his new reality. Meaning he's saying that at this point, what are our two primary purposes? One purpose is study of Torah. The other purpose is to make Korban Pesach of lesser status, to understand that the matzah is actually the primary focus. And there's therefore an interesting move that Rabbi Gamliel is making. He's not simply trying to continue the earlier practice and trying to perpetuate the existence of the Second Temple in this post-temple period, but actually what he's doing is, in a certain sense, he's sanitizing that earlier practice. In a certain sense, he's saying that earlier practice was never really that significant in the first place, because that earlier practice was always really secondary to the Korban Pesach itself, and now we also have this other practice of Talmud Torah, and therefore we should really involve ourselves in the study of Torah rather than focus on the Korban Pesach or whatever continuation there is of the Korban Pesach. So Rabbi Gamliel's move is very subtle. Yes?
What if you switch the question a bit? If the question is not the perpetuation of the Pesach, the question is the perpetuation of the holiday and Jewish continuity. And what Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Akiva and other places are actually fighting for is, once we don't have the temple, by all these aesthetics, everything will go away. So you can't make that argument too strong. So all they're left with is their subtlety. So what you're seeing is a construction. And I think I would suggest that if you reverse it, the two missions. The most important point is behold over Dorchayavadam Lorosis Asma. Because if you don't have symbols that you're bringing, you've got to do it up here. And that's the connection that you'll maintain your Jewishness, your Pesach that way. That what they're doing is not a subtle scholastic shift, that what they're doing is recreating the world within the very limited parameters.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The one thing, Bechol Dor Vador, is that it's relatively clear that that wasn't... I think the point is very fair, and that I agree that the purpose of Bechol Dor Vador is to do precisely what you're suggesting. In the case of Bechol Dor Vador, it's basically absent in what I said are the best manuscripts of the Mishnah. It's not simply this one. It's absent in the entire...
The best by a scholastic criteria.
Yeah, I agree that as a phenomenological or experiential point, I completely agree with that, yeah. Very fair. Yeah.
You dated Gamliel from the Second Temple on. What happened between the first and the second?
No, but the destruction of the temple takes place.
After the destruction of the first.
Yeah.
Until they built the second, what did they do?
I don't know. So that's a good question. We don't have any evidence of it. Yeah.
Couldn't it be argued that Rabbi Gamliel was also kind of leapfrogging back to the where you have to kind of talk about it, and that kind of precedes the temple, precedes all that, so that gives them free reign and still puts them within the sources.
So it what's right. So what's interesting is that
he has something to anger.
So I think what's interesting is that the focus on what you said, Vahigad Zalivincha, is actually going to come out of the next set of sources, which are going to, less Rabban Gamliel and more from the Mishnah, which we'll take a look at now. So if I've suggested that the first stage between the destruction and the post-temple destruction is represented by this series of steps by Rabban Gamliel, the second stage, I think, is represented by the Mishnah itself. Because there are two differences between Rabban Gamliel and this earlier practice and that of the Mishnah. The first difference is that whereas Rabban Gamliel's statement is still basically centered as still basically centered around the Korban Pesach, meaning all of the rituals essentially surround them, where his study of Torah is not taking place during the meal, it's taking place after the meal. So his meal consists of the Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. He's interpreting their symbolic significance during the meal. So it's still centered upon the Korban Pesach, or whatever version he has. The Mishnah, though, does two things. It doesn't emphasize the study of the halachot, but it does emphasize the telling of the story, and it moves that recitation from after the meal to the meal itself, meaning your involvement with things other than the food is no longer after the meal, it's during the meal. That's clear from the Mishnah, which describes the bringing of the, what time is it? 9:08. Can I have a, come on, okay. Which describes the Mishnah describes the bringing out of the food right before you pour the second cup. Once the food is on the table, you pour the second cup, and then you begin telling the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. And so we're away now from the study of the halachot after the meal to the telling of the story during the meal. Now, what exactly does that shift represent? As we'll see in a minute, and we're going to have to do this very briefly, what happens at that point is that the foods, the Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, are no longer foods that you eat. They're props. They're rituals that are meant to prompt the questions, why is this night different than any other night? The Mishnah goes even further than Rabban Gamliel in de-emphasizing the Pesach by saying even the bringing of the Korban Pesach is only important as a ritual prop for the son's questions. That's even a further, more far-reaching move than even what Rabban Gamliel suggested. Let's take a look at that briefly in the Mishnah. So if we look at the first source, we don't actually have enough time, so I'm going to actually just have to say this outside. You can consult the sources at your leisure. What Rabban Gamliel, what the Mishnah says is you bring out three things. Okay, and again, this is attested in the best manuscripts and not in the printed manuscripts. You bring out three things. This is in both set of manuscripts. You bring out meat, you bring out maror, and you bring out matzah. At that point, the questions of the son are prompted. But the best manuscripts of the Mishnah don't have four questions at that point. They actually only have three questions. And those three questions precisely revolve around the three foods that have been brought out at that point. Why do we bring the Korban Pesach? And the Mishnah seems to assume that you're still eating roasted meat. The question is clear from the better manuscripts of the Mishnah that you're still asking the question about the roasted meat. Why do we dip not once but twice tonight? They used to dip once at that time in Israel. What were they dipping? They were dipping the maror. So why is it that you're bringing the maror out again? We've already eaten the maror earlier at Karpas, right? We've eaten the vegetable earlier. Why are you bringing it out again as if you're going to be dipping it? And why is it that we're eating the matzah? So it's clear that what the Mishnah is trying to get at is it's trying to bring out the three foods at the stage immediately preceding the questions in order to prompt the questions that follow. These are no longer foods which are significant in and of themselves. These are foods that are simply ritual props for what? For the telling of the story. because now the story itself is the focus, no longer the study of the halachot, and the foods themselves are no longer inherently significant. The foods themselves are simply ritual props. And so what the Mishnah does is, the Mishnah goes one stage beyond Rabbi Gamliel. We're not even interested in the eating of the foods anymore, and we're not really interested even of the study of the Hilchot HaPesach later in the night. All that we're interested in doing is recounting the story and using those foods simply as props for the son's question about the story itself. And so the Mishnah needs to be understood as a further stage in the process. And I can go back to your point earlier. How is it that B'chol Dovar Dovar, how are we on the way toward B'chol Dovar Dovar? Because at this point, it's no longer about those earlier foods. It's beginning to be about the experience of the night. And the next stage is to say, we ourselves are part of that experience. So I think I'm out of time. I have 3 minutes for questions?
Yes,
okay, 3 minutes for questions. Yes?
Any indication historically what the Jews did after the kibbutz and before the first temple?
No, we don't. The only thing that we know is that the Korban Pesach was not brought during the 40 years in the Midbar. Yehoshua says that the first thing they did when they crossed the Yarden was to bring the Korban Pesach, because they hadn't given themselves circumcision throughout those 40 years, and since that's prerequisite. But we don't know exactly what happens after that point. Yeah.
Yes.
What was involved with the Hegadah
Salavincha? Oh, so, right.
I mean, going back to what I was saying.
Yeah, so,
before,
so the,
obviously,
yeah.
Obviously, there was a period before even there was a Korbanot.
Right, right.
And then even during the period when they did have the Korbanot, there was still the mitzvah from the
Torah. Right.
Of Hegadah
presumably, I assume that they were telling the story.
But
we
not
know.
Just the Holocaust.
Right. We know from Second Temple source. We know from one particular Second Temple source that what they were doing is there was a lot of hallel and singing. I assume that they were also telling the story, but it didn't occupy the primary role that the Korban Pesach did.
But
so
that was the mitzvah fulfilled.
I assume that it was considered. So my assumption is that the Higadat Levincha was subsumed under the rubric of the Korban Pesach, and that yes, it was an independent mitzvah, but that it still seems to have been secondary to the Korban itself. Yeah. Did you have a question?
Yeah,
sorry.
Just a curiosity. You mentioned that for the Korban Pesach, you couldn't use a spit or a grape. How do you roast without a spit or a grape?
That's a good question. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. I imagine that it was in some, you know, the way that the Korban Pesach was roasted, it was roasted standing up. Why is it that Jesus comes to be understood as the Paschal sacrifice, the Korban Pesach? Because the Korban Pesach itself looked like something that was on a cross. It was standing up with some kind of spit or grate or something down its middle, and so it had direct exposure to the fire. And so it looked very much like a cross. That seems to be the reason why that imagery developed. I don't know. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
These are all questions that are raised.
Right.
I remember, as a youngster, I know the source of this. People thought who wouldn't have roasted.
Yeah. And that's right. Right. And that's again. That's all of these things are further outgrowths of the Mishnah. The Mishnah still seems to have imagined, or actually had, roasted meat at the Seder, but what's happened by de-emphasizing the roasted meat and instead using them as ritual props and focusing instead on telling the stories, that eventually both Rabbi Gamliel and the Mishnah achieve their purpose, namely eliminating the Korban Pesach as an essential piece. Right. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mermelstein. The next lecture is April 24th, 8:15, right? 8:15, with Dr. Egan.